Calling all benders and non-benders alike. Jump into the epic world of Avatar with your favorite podcast, Avatar Braving the Elements. Hosted by me, Janet Varney.
And me, Dante Bosco. Each week we'll recap and discuss a new episode.
So come join us and our amazing guests, from creators to cast to superfans, to chat about all things Avatarverse.
It's Fire Nation time. Book of Fire. Let's go. Listen to Avatar Braving the Elements
wherever you get your podcasts.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
And we are coming to you live from a couple of places on the internet. We are live on Facebook, YouTube, Twitch, X/Twitter, Instagram. Maybe you're listening later on Spotify, Apple, Android, or the app of your choice. Wherever you're listening, that's awesome. That's great. And our hearts go out to our co-host, Pete, who is sick this week. I heard a rumor that he has mono and the kissing disease, but I don't want to say.
You're really spreading that. He just said he was sick and didn't say with what. So I don't know. It feels like I asked for a doctor's note, and I want one. I'm not resting until he does that.
Well, he's not going to get the PTO if he doesn't, get us the doctor's
note. The CBC PTO.
Yes, exactly. We're very locked up in the business end of this podcast, 100%. Our HR department right now is very unhappy with Pete.
That's true. And it helps that Pete is the HR department, which has been a mistake from our side.
Yeah, it was something we have to rectify. But what we don't have to rectify is the two amazing guests that we have on the show tonight for you. Later in the show, we're going to bring in Tessa Halls. But right now, why don't we bring in a returning guest? He is the creator of the effects of pickled herring. Ladies and gentlemen, Alex Schumacher. Alex, welcome back to the show. Hello.
Hey guys.
Hello.
How are you?
How are you? It's good to see you again. Excited to talk about this book. Also excited to talk about your very tidy workspace. I love it.
I imagine just piles of laundry just out of frame. Is that accurate? Basically,
I tried to frame it so you can't see the actual clutter, of which there is quite a bit in here. But I also want to point out that this is the second time that Pete's conveniently been absent when I've been on the show.
Yes.
This is a man who claims to be a fan of what I do, yet somehow every time I'm on the show, he's not here. So
yeah,
I don't know.
I'm sick. Sick of Alex Schumacher is what
Whoa!
So I understand that, though.
That's awful. That is awful behavior. I don't
well, it's like enjoy the art, not the artist, I guess, kind of thing for him.
Yeah, he doesn't want to meet his heroes. That's always fair.
We're always disappointments. Yeah. As I intimate, I'm one of his heroes.
Maybe it's true. We'll never know because you're not here at the same time. Let's talk about this book. This book came out back a week, 2 weeks ago, something like that. Yeah, 2 weeks ago. It's great. It's a not exactly all ages book. I guess like middle grade is what we're calling it.
Middle grade debut, technically.
Yeah. And this is a very different mode for you, just based on that, in terms of going into the middle grade. Before we even get into the content of the book, what led to that? Because the last time we talked to you a couple of years back, you were definitely doing things that skewed more adult, were more aimed towards adults. So why dip your toe into middle grade?
Yeah, it's odd to go from, you know, political commentary to something that's, you know, aimed at a much younger audience. But I guess the genesis of that was, you know, beginning to work with an agent towards the traditional book market and sort of the burgeoning category there, especially for graphic novels, is the middle grade category. And I've always been interested in exploring, you know, slice of life, Romana Clef, kind of very heavily inspired by my own life stories. So this gave me the opportunity to not just kind of continue that pattern of, you know, putting my life on the page, but was also a way for me to touch on things like cognitive decline for a younger audience. There doesn't seem to be that many books that cover Alzheimer's, dementia, all those things that kids may or may not have relatives that are living with those ailments. So this was a way to maybe give them a reference point, something to talk to, something to talk about with their parents. And even if it could do that for a couple of kids, I think that's something that we should all kind of aspire to do. I mean, the kids are, you know, they're the next generation. If, you know, we've got to try and teach them to the best of our ability and include them to the best of our ability, because that's the part that I think we have trouble with doing sometimes.
That's really cool. Did you, now, since you're diving into this sort of a new area, did you know you wanted to start there, or were you sort of like thinking about just ways in to a younger audience?
No, I tend to go kind of, you know, I don't want to say melodramatic, but maybe edgy is giving myself too credit too, but I tend to want to discuss the more difficult topics, and not for any reason of like bringing a grim tone to someone's day, but more for, you know, building a relationship, building a connection. People are experiencing these things all the time. And if you can reach out, you know, from your book and, you know, connect with one person, give one person, you know, something that they feel reflects their own journey, then, I mean, that's always something to aspire to as an artist.
It's funny you say that. We've been talking.
Can I just lay out one thing, just because sure. I think we skipped over like the basic premise a little bit. Like, I know you talked about you have a relative in the book who right. is dealing with Alzheimer's or dementia, maybe a combination of both. But this focuses on this kid who is definitely not you, somebody else, who is studying for his bar mitzvah, wrestling with growing up, potentially asking somebody out. He has a sister who's a twin sister, right? Who
10 months older.
10 so, months older.
What do they call those? Irish twins? I don't know if that's... Irish.
Yes.
I don't know if that's twins. Not anymore. It probably funny. Is, but yeah.
And they're also growing apart, or more specifically, she's growing apart and he doesn't know how to deal with it. So he's dealing with a lot of stuff, but the focus, the through line really is what's going on with this grandmother. That's the thing you keep coming back to. And without getting too much into spoilers, is the thing that you end with. Yeah. That setup out of the way, Justin, back to you.
Well, I was just going to say, we've talked about a lot, the idea you mentioned edginess, that yeah. so many stories for younger audiences today sort of have the edges sanded off, and we were missing the stories from when we were a kid that were like, whoa, that's dark. But there's something about that I think they live on in my memory much more than the sort of softer stories that came after.
Oh, I absolutely agree. And you know, that's part of my aim too, is it's not to sort of be thought of as edgy or, you know, controversial or, you know, whatever the case may be. It's about kind of carrying on that tradition that was pretty big for us. And I think, you know, maybe we didn't have the best conversations about things like, you know, self-care and mental health and things like that, but they were in the books, and they didn't seem to be sort of excluded, those kind of topics, you know, in a way that they are now. So yeah, to answer the original question, I don't think it was ever thought in my mind to do something different. That was always going to be the story that I was at least pitching first for a middle grade story. It was one that had been kind of percolating, you know, in the mind for a bit. And I just saw this, you know, this kind of heartbreaking but beautiful parallel between a sort of literal coming of age in the Jewish culture paired with suddenly being thrust into this very adult issue, you know, and in a world that can feel adults only sometimes, you're now a part of this, and that can be very jarring.
And you knew yeah. that if there's one thing that speaks to the middle grade audience, it's pickled herring.
Absolutely.
This is why yeah. you put it front and center.
Well, yeah. I mean, isn't that still served in like lunchroom cafeterias? It's like fries and pickled herring are the two most sought after. You know,
my 9-year-old is upstairs right now going ham on a whole.
I imagine, if it's not, we've done something wrong.
Oh, seriously. I mean, I had pickled herring Go-Gurt, pickled herring gummy bears. Oh. That stuff is yum. Spray a bag of Go-Gurt.
Yeah, I don't know. So,
more seriously, though, what led to this? Because, again, no, not too many spoilers, but there was a surprisingly little but important amount yeah. of pickled herring in the book. So yeah. why hook the cover? Why hook the title on that?
Because it's a heavier book in a lot of places. There are some somber moments going on, but there's also a lot of humor that runs throughout. You know, that's a part of my writing process as well, is to mix the comedy with the, you know, cataclysmic to some degree. So especially since this is aimed at middle grade, I really wanted to emphasize the humor on the cover. I wanted that to be something that was evident from the get-go. So that moment in the book that you're referencing, that we won't spoil for people, is a very funny and kind of, you know, lighthearted moment that only a child would really wonder about. So to feature that on the cover, I felt was maybe, you know, a better way to attract people, to sort of pull kids and maybe even parents in, as opposed to maybe focusing on one of the more heavier aspects.
And the Scandinavian readers will really appreciate this.
Absolutely. Yeah, why not? I mean, you know, get Norway, get Iceland.
Get Norway, get the world. Yeah. I worked at a Scandinavian restaurant, so I've had my hands on a lot of pickled herring over the years.
If I can make it there, I can make it anywhere.
Yeah.
Can you talk about fictionalizing your own life and where you touch on your life versus veering away from that in this book?
Yeah. It was, you know, I tend to say about 50-50, because the way that I tend to infuse, you know, memories or anecdotes with the more fictional side, that line tends to blur a lot for me. So, I say it's about 50-50, but for me, I originally intended to kind of just mine my own memories and then use a ton of artistic license to then maybe go back and fill in those gaps to create the rest of the story. But very soon in that process, I found that our memories are fallible and they're processing a ton of information at all times. So we have gaps. That's a very normal thing to have. So I kind of recruited my family, and it became sort of a joint effort to bring, you know, just get, you know, collecting memories and stories and recollections from my mom and my aunt and, you know, even my uncle up in Oregon and my sister, just really making it a joint effort, which was, you know, when I thought back on that, was really special in a way, because my grandparents, who have been gone for over a decade, one of their big things was, you know, that old adage that nobody accomplishes anything significant alone. I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, that's the old adage. So I think for them to know that we kind of did it as a family, did it together, and brought, you know, those memories and that story, as manipulated as it is, you know, in the book, I think they'd be really happy to know that, you know, we did that together. And it was something that brought, you know, their story. You know, it wasn't just that we told the story together, it was we told their story together in a way.
That's so cool. And now are they constantly like, so what's up with the book? For the whole process, it was a family, they were all invested heavily, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, I love my parents, but they're very Jewish parents. So, you know, sometimes you and I mean, I don't think that's, you know, specific to Jewish parents. I just think sometimes, you know, we need things that are just ours, right? So I've always thought of the creative process and art as, you know, kind of just being mine, a solitary thing I can do. But it just occurred to me that it made so much sense to really mine all of our experiences, to pool all of those, because that's the only way it was going to really feel lived in and authentic. If I had a bunch of different, you know, perspectives and memories of what my grandmother was like, both before and after the Alzheimer's.
We have exactly a question here, but this is something I wanted to touch on with you. Were you bar mitzvahed?
Yes. With my sister, who is 10 months older.
Oh interesting.
Oh, very true. Yeah. So I know I had heard a review, a buddy named Ray found me on Twitter, and he has a podcast called Rabbit Stew, and they did this really nice review of it. And he was saying that he was raised in the Orthodox temple, which is girls are bat mitzvah at 12 there instead of 13. So he said that kind of threw him. But then when he saw the woman rabbi, he went, this isn't an Orthodox or
conservative.
It was very clear. And I did that intentionally for, you know, in a lot of ways, kind of, I was trying to make it very clear. This was a West Coast reform movement. We're kind of the hippies of Jews, as it were, or I'm sure some people think of us that way. So that was, favorite bar mitzvah story. Oh boy. Well, when they were lifting me up in the chairs at, at the reception, they almost dropped me. So my my life both began and almost ended during my bar mitzvah.
Wow.
To be a man in the Jewish religion is also to die. I've always
said. Correct. Yeah, I mean that's to accept that that's inevitable at 14 or 13. it's one of those things that is really kind of an ordeal, and that the I did kind of want to capture as you're preparing for it, because the actual party itself is of course a party, but the you know year or so leading up to it is absolute chaos. And you know when you're 12 or 13 can also feel torturous.
Can I tell you, not to interrupt, but I just from my own experience, because I was also bar mitzvahed, I don't remember a lot of it, but I do very distinctly reaching a point where I was like, this is not fun. I don't want to do this anymore. And I told my dad, and I was like, I'm sorry, I'm not enjoying this. I do not want to get bar mitzvahed. And he has never done this before. He's a good dad. He's very nice. He's very supportive. But he was like, you're getting bar mitzvahed.
Yeah.
You're doing it. Get back to studying your Haftorah right now.
Yeah. Because that's the thing is it's always, you know, it's never anything that a 12 or 13 year old actually wants to do. We don't want to be inside studying, you know, this ancient language that, you know, we have some connection to sort of through our heritage and ancestors and stuff. But, you know, when you're 12, you don't really care about that. And, you know, I think in some ways, you know, not to go too deep into this, but, you know, religion is one of those things that's they're not really doing much outreach to youth. And the kind of outreach that they're doing tends to be, I don't know, sometimes questionable. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, you're never doing that for yourself. It's always for your family. But then you look back on it. The nice thing is you then have this really beautiful, positive, you know, experience that you had that connects you to, you know, thousands of years of people.
Yeah.
I didn't have a bar mitzvah, but I played. Yeah. I mean, seriously, it sounds scary and
just
fun.
Have one. You know.
You're right. Let's do that on Comic Book Club.
Adult bar mitzvahs are a thing now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really? Great.
Yeah. I mean, converts do it for sure.
Mm-hmm. I did play Seth Meyers in a video for someone's very expensive bar mitzvah where we did me and an Amy Poehler stand-in. We did a really about the kid getting bar mitzvahed. And I was like, this kid is going to hate this. We are roasting him.
Yeah.
And they played the video at the...
Yeah, I don't recall any roasting at my bar mitzvah, thankfully. So, I mean, that probably happened.
Wait, no, I also got roasted at my bar mitzvah, but by my friends did in front. I guess that's a thing.
Of course. I mean, yeah, you're going to get roasted by your loved ones. Mm-hmm. That's just the thing that happens, I think. And especially in such a, you know, vulnerable, embarrassing position when you're young. Of course, that's what people are going to pick on.
Yeah.
But it's only the people who truly love you that are going to do that. Mm-hmm. Because they know it's
That's a nice way.
Well, you know,
that's a great way of justifying.
It's taking like 30 some odd years of reflection. But it's something I think I realize now is you do that with people because you're safe with them and they know, you know, you're not going to get hurt by them saying those things.
Yeah.
And that's true. I was a total stranger hired to do it for someone.
Well, that's a different scenario. So I don't know how much trauma you guys caused those kids.
Someday, some 17-year-old is going to come up to you and be like, you son of a bitch.
Yeah. I knew it was you.
I found you. Yeah. I told you I would find you.
My mortal enemy.
Alex, now that you've done this, now that you've done a pseudo memoir type thing, now that you've done a middle grade book, do you have any hankering to do more of that, or do you want to get back to the more adult work you've done it before, or both? I guess
I think the younger audiences are going to be my focus for a little bit. I'm actually the manuscript that I'm finishing up now and about to get to my agent, which will be our next book that we're shopping, is more young adult, but that's probably about as old as I'm planning to go for a little while. There's a lot of stories to tell about growing up that, you know, kids need to hear or would be good for them to hear. You're reaching such a prime age for development and for having these conversations about asking questions and forming your own opinions And it's so important that we're talking to them like actual people. So a lot of, not a lot, but, you know, some of the books that I see, like you touched on before, tend to either, you know, buff the edges off so it makes, yeah, you know, the story a little prettier, or just shies away from topics like this altogether. So if I can do a little bit to bring more of those topics to light for these kids who have very complex and perplexing lives, who experience all these things, you know, I hope that if my stories can bring a little bit of either relief or, you know, make them feel less isolated, then that's something I'd like to focus on for a little bit. And this is after some talks with my agent, you know, as well, kind of deciding what to focus on. Yeah. So it's about reaching a new audience, which is something, you know, I haven't done before. So it's an exciting prospect too, to really have those talks and maybe be able to go to schools and have those talks in person.
Well, you're off to a great start. This is a very fun and touching book at the same time. Excited to read whatever is next, and great seeing you again. Thanks for coming on, Alex.
You guys too. I'll definitely let you know when the next book is coming out.
Yeah, please do.
All right. Great book.
Have a good night. You can untidy your room now. You can push all
that. Yeah, right. I'm just going
to open the closet and let the avalanche fall out. Let's see what's
going to happen. Awesome. Thanks, Alex.
All right, guys. Thanks.
Thanks, Alex. All have
right,
a good one.
There you go. Once again, the book is called The Effects of Pickled Herring. That was Alex Schumacher. You can check it out in stores everywhere now. Speaking of books that are in stores everywhere now, you can check out our next one. It's called Feeding Ghosts. And our next guest is the creator of that book, Tessa Halls. Tessa, welcome. Hello.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on. I love this book. I'm very excited to talk about it. But first, I think we have to get out of the way in our room patrol here. What's going on for anybody listening on the audio podcast? You seem to be, there's like, I think a bridge outside behind you. There's three squares next to your head. What's going on?
Okay, so I'm kind of a polymath and I do a lot of different things, but the thing that I'm really bad at is staying still. So I've been using BookTour as an excuse to go visit everyone I've ever known all over the country. And I've been on the road for 6 weeks. And so I'm in Montana right now. And before this interview, I was up at a friend's off-grid cabin with a chainsaw helping mill lumber and was like, I have to go into town to find somewhere to do this interview. So I went to the place that solves pretty much everything in the world and asked the public library. So I'm doing this from the Helena Public Library with my boots full of sawdust in one of the rooms.
Yes.
Oh, man. The nice thing about that is that makes you
chainsaw guests.
Yes. Exactly. Well, thank you for putting the lumber to the side, I guess is the thing to come to.
Oh, Alex, such a familiarity with the woodworking. What a pro.
I've never heard of wood before.
The trees are lumber, right? Okay.
It makes the sheets that you draw the things on. It eventually becomes paper.
Familiar. I'm sorry. I mostly watch TV, so I wouldn't worry about it. But I did at least read this one book, which is a phenomenal book. You know, it actually has a bunch of ties to the book we were just talking about with Alex, because again, this is another book about intergenerational, about dealing with your culture. Here you're dealing with three generations, which is yourself, your mother, and your grandmother. It's also one of the big differences between this, for anybody who's listening who's not familiar with the book, between what Alex did and what you're doing, is you are literally in the book. It's not just your story. You're narrating it pretty much the entire time and trying to figure out your own history. Talk about this approach. What led to this very first person looking at the, not screen, but you know what I mean, approach to presenting the book?
I mean, the short answer is I failed at not doing that. it's basically, I grew up with this sort of trauma loop within my own family of my grandmother Sun Yi was a journalist in Shanghai during the communist takeover. And so she lived in our nuclear family and basically sat at her writing desk, just endlessly rewriting the stories of her past, because what happened to her after the communists came to power is Maoist thought reform broke her mind. And so I initially was going to tell this story, just digging to the history. I was not going to be a character. But in trying to answer the question of what broke my family, I really started to see that the book was going to have to be about all of the squishy emotional damage that I never wanted to touch. And so me coming in as the narrator was kind of my way of basically conceding that to tell this story honestly, it was going to require going to some territory that really scared me. And I figured I would just break the fourth wall and invite the viewer along.
One That's choice cool. that you make that I thought was really fascinating was starting the book. I think it's the first double page splash that happens very quickly where you're like, real quick, I'm going to lay out the entire history of China, basically, just like on one page, which is normally, I would say, too much at the beginning, but it really sets the tone for the rest of the book, which is, and I use this complimentarily, but overwhelming in terms of the amount of information you're presenting there, because I think you as a person and a character, what I interpret off that, is overwhelmed about this amount of information, all this history, and had to figure out how to whittle it down until it ultimately answers some questions about you. Was that the choice there? Is that what led to that?
Well, I think the inclusion of the timeline, I've always thought about my job as a maker is to lead someone through a landscape. And so I have to make them a trail, especially if I'm bringing them somewhere really wild, really remote, really huge. And so by opening with that timeline, I wanted to make sure that my reader was always going to be able to situate what was happening within the broader context. And there's a visual device that I use in one of the panels where I'm talking about how my grandmother's mental breakdown was part of what was happening in mainland China. And so I illustrate a series of Russian nesting dolls where, you know, you've got the big Mao, you got the small grandma. And I think for me, I always knew I was going to be shifting between the microcosm and the macrocosm. And that's why I chose to do this book as a graphic novel, because you basically like can't do that to someone just in text. They would be so lost. And so it was really just a sneak attack way of being able to shove like the density of a black hole into this thing without hopefully the viewer understanding how much I was demanding of them.
Go ahead, Justin.
Sorry, to jump in. Once you sort of made the choice to put yourself in the story, how did that change the creation process for you? And like, as opposed to what Alex was saying earlier, where he was, you know, 50% was fictionalized, since this is like sort of your story, is that more of an, you're editing the emotional story here, or how does that work?
Well, as I got further into the book, my narrator started taking a more active role, like would sometimes literally hijack scenes or would like pop in a frame and contradict something that was just said. And so I started to refer to her as my rogue honey badger. And honestly, I mean, I don't know if it's just, you know, I spent 9 years on this, so maybe I just lost my mind somewhere along the way. But ultimately, I felt like I didn't have a huge amount of control over her as a character. And the book is kind of built in trinities. And, you know, I'm working with past, present, future, myself, my mom, my grandmother, China, Hong Kong, America. And so I think that that for me, I had my narrator character, my cowboy character, and my historian character. And so for me, like breaking my personality and my role within the story into actual characters who wandered through at different points was kind of the only way that I felt I could honestly tell a story that held so many contradictions.
I mean, not to push you too much on this and speak on it if you want or not, but do you feel at all putting yourself in the book this way, talking about yourself this way as separate characters, was that a way of removing yourself from the story?
Just absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, I got to find some way to avoid emotions, but No, I think ultimately when I started realizing where the conclusion was going, and I was like, well, fuck, there's no amount of compartmentalizing that is going to allow me to not have to wade into the emotional resonance of this.
Wow. You said this took you 9 years. What, I mean, obviously every day I'm sure was a little bit different, but what was the process like actually putting this together?
I would say the first 4 years were mostly research. Because, you know, my grandmother, I knew that she had been a famous journalist and that after she and my mom fled to Hong Kong, she'd written this best-selling memoir. And I knew that it was critical of the Communist Party, but didn't really have the broader cultural context to understand just how radical and dangerous that was. And so I had to get a bunch of grant funding because I spent about 4 months total on two separate trips over in Hong Kong and China, and then commissioned a translation of my grandma's memoir. And so kind of getting the footwork of everything I needed to know about Chinese history and my family's role within it. I would say that was the first 4 years, was just gathering all of the requisite material. And then the last 4 years, which pretty much coincided with COVID, which was somewhere between brutal and devastating. That was when I was actually doing the production of the actual pages. And it was just like a death march to the finish line.
What a crucible to go through, where you're writing this intensely personal story and then you're also alone for a big chunk of it. I don't even know what the question is there. You said it was devastating, but was there any point in there where you were like, I have to break out of this, I need to start a new project, or were you just grinding the whole time?
Well, I mean, for better or for worse, I've always been compulsively reliable, and I had a contract. There was no getting out of it. So I think there was a point at which you sort of need that external motivation of someone telling you have to do it. To touch more on the brutal part, I mean, it was made worse by the fact that just before COVID, I was doing this thing called the Marjorie Davis Boyden Wilderness Writing Residency, where one writer a year gets to basically go totally rogue, and they're given a remote cabin in the wilderness, completely off grid, no cell service, no internet. And it's a 2-hour drive from the nearest town on back logging roads. And so it's actually, this comes full circle to the beginning. It's probably the only writing residency, I'm guessing, in the world where one of the requirements is you have to be comfortable using a chainsaw, because if it's tree falls, like, nobody's going to come fix it for you. And so that's where I wrote the outline of the book and found the structure. And so I had been just alone with a dog on 94 acres and no human contact for half a year. And I got out a few months before COVID hit. So
what was the day like when you finished the last page of the book?
You know what's funny is I actually don't remember what the last page I drew was, because I didn't do it sequentially. I think for me, I had been wanting to just be done and have my life back for so many years that the first thing I did is I got a job working as a landscaper, because I just wanted to move rocks and do the exact opposite of just living in my head in a small room. So I don't know. I think I felt relief, but then the long production process, I don't know. I use a lot of Lord of the Rings metaphors in talking about this book and how, like, Frodo didn't really want to death march across Mordor and throw the ring in Mount Doom. And that's very much how I felt about this project. But then once you've done it, you know, it takes like a year and a half between when you deliver and the book finally comes out. And it was just like, I guess I have to sit next to this volcano just waiting.
I think that's a really good metaphor, honestly, because the experience, and again, I want to be very clear on being complimentary here, but the experience of reading the book, it's very exhausting because there's so much and you're living in this space as you're reading it. At least I did as I was reading it. Getting to the end there for you, because you are dealing with the history of your mother, the history of your grandmother, your family, did you feel any catharsis there? Do you feel like you've been able to put things behind you in terms of that headspace, in terms of that family trauma? Or I don't know.
I'll answer like all of that depressing material by talking about something that's maybe even more depressing, but in a sort of like sweet way. Because really, like, there was no way I couldn't change the content of the book. It was a true story. It was just an epically fucking depressing story about like how someone's mind can be destroyed by politics, and then how that can continue to ricochet, like ruining relationships for generations thereafter. And I couldn't change that. But the point at which I started to feel catharsis was something very sad happened. And my mom has had dementia for a couple of years, so another parallel with the previous guest. But basically, just as the book was ramping in to come out, she had a stroke, and so it went off a cliff. And so my next frontier is basically stepping in more and more to caretake my mother. And I am seeing the amazing benefits of having written this book, because it changed our relationship in such a way that we are now able to face this like absolutely fucking awful frontier in a place where she trusts me. So I don't think it's catharsis, but I am now feeling like, oh, there was an enormous gift that both of us got out of me doing this.
Wow.
That's amazing.
That is really amazing. I did want to ask you, just because, as you mentioned, your grandmother was a journalist. This is, I think, very much a form of journalism as well, and you've done other writing beyond that. Why do you think you picked up that profession? Do you think you picked it up from your grandmother? Is there a genetic predisposition to journalism, potentially? What do you think happened there?
Well, making this book is what forced me to become a journalist and a historian, because just the scale of what I'm covering, I'm using my family's story to give a crash course in 100 years of Chinese history. And in order to be able to do that to the both ethical and technical standards that I felt that it demanded, I basically had to create these two entirely separate careers. And so it's interesting, because I think people who are coming at this externally, probably like you, assumed that these were things I was already doing, and thus it made sense for me to turn those pre-existing things into this book. Whereas it was actually the exact opposite, where the moment at which I couldn't run from the story any further and knew that I had to tell it, and was basically like, well, oh, fuck. that was the point at which I had to lay out this plan where, okay, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to need to become all these things that I'm currently not, because that's what this is going to take. So it's been a long time.
That's wild to me, because for anybody who hasn't read this book, I'll say just to our listeners and our viewers, this is extraordinarily well-researched and laid out and presented throughout, just in terms of the way you are laying out this very personal story, and the way that, like we've been talking about, it focuses in so narrowly and then blows it out and then manages to tie the two together. So very good job. You did it first time out of the gate.
Well, awesome. I didn't draw comics before this book. I learned this medium for this book because I knew it was the only way I could pull it off. And so that was actually super fun, as someone who hadn't been raised on the canon, because I was mostly a painter and a writer, and then knew that I was going to have to learn this medium that was the synthesis of words and image. And so I didn't really start reading graphic novels and comics until I was 30. And it was fun kind of coming in fluent in other disciplines to be able to, like, it's like I wasn't coming in totally green. It was like you speak one romance language and you learn another one and you're like, oh, I recognize some of these verb conjugations. Mm-hmm. But yeah, just getting to like read comics in a total bender in adulthood was actually, I think, a great way to do it.
Can you tell us what you read or what was most sort of helpful / inspiring?
Yeah, well, so partially because I was trying to learn, I didn't want to immediately turn to just like the upper pantheon. And so I'm based out of Seattle, and I would go to the Central Library and I would just pick like a linear foot of graphic novels at random and then bring them home and do little like sketchbook critiques where I would draw a couple panels in the style of that writer and artist and sort of see like, what are they doing? How does the structure work? I mean, ultimately, I think the biggest touchstone for me was Fun Home. That's the closest. Mm-hmm. And then Mouse, obviously, Persepolis, The Best We Could Do. And I think because I was coming to the format later, I tended to read more graphic novels than comics. Right.
So just to check, you going into this, you weren't a journalist, you weren't a graphic novel creator, and then you just knock this out.
But you're good with a chainsaw and chill with being alone for a long stretches of time.
Yeah. That's accurate.
It feels like you like to you put yourself through something when you're making something. What are you doing to work on your next thing? Like Lost at Sea, some sort of space adventure?
Well, actually, you're not too far off the mark, because really what I want to do, and I think that's what was so agonizing for me about how long this book took, because, you know, it's 400 pages and I hand drew the whole thing in Japanese brush pen. I calculated it. It was 4,000 square feet of drawings. And also 60,000 words, which is a lot for a graphic novel, but that's because I was like sneak attack putting a 900-page history book there. But anyways, I've known for years that sort of my feral wilderness life and my creative life, I've kept them very separate, but I want them to be entwined.
Yeah.
And so I did something last spring called the Alaska Voices of the Wilderness Residency, where instead of like giving an artist a cute cabin to work on their own stuff, they send you out in the field in remote sites in Alaska. And so they tailor what they do to the experience level and interests of their artists. And so I got paired with the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and they were pretty thrilled to get an artist with a lot of Alaska backcountry experience. So we got dropped off by bush plane north of the Arctic Circle and spent 9 days pack rafting the Marsh Fork of the Canning River. And that's what I'm finishing up now, is a comic about that. And so basically that's what I'm trying to move into, is I want to become an embedded comics journalist working.
I was just going to say, you're like on the ground with a brush pen.
That's amazing.
So that's what I'm going to try and pivot to. Cause I think like, I am not an indoor kitty. I am not cut out for just being chained to a drafting table for years.
I'm just thinking about how today I took my son to 7-Eleven while we were walking home, and instead of my regular Coke Slurpee, I got a mango Slurpee, and I thought I was adventurous, but I think I might be wrong. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, that's when you encountered some lumber, right, Alex?
Yes, exactly.
And now so what you're doing with the Alaska Preserve folks, is that first person as well, or is it stepping out of your experience?
Well, they have a draft, and I'm curious to see what they're going to make of it, because I called it a travelogue travelogue turned history deep dive. Because again, it was something where like I went in there thinking, oh, this would be a great thing. I've been so burned out with this book. I'll just go to some beautiful, wild place. And then, of course, I ended up reading like 18 books and learned that the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is perhaps the most politically contentious piece of land, certainly in America. And it's like the collision of like Western frontier myth and the history of preservation and oil rights. So, I mean, they did pick me for this, so they probably should have known.
Hilarious.
Man, I can't wait to read that. Tessa, this book is utterly fantastic. If people want to find out more about it, where should they go to check out, other than heading to the public library, obviously?
I would say check out my website, just tessahulls.com, or I'm on Instagram as @tessahulls. Thanks, parents, for giving me a unique but phonetic name. And I'm out on book tour. So I just sublet my place for 6 months. So when I say that I'm using book tour as an excuse to visit all of my friends, regardless of where they live, like, I'm just on the road for the foreseeable future.
Well, what city are you going to be in next, if listeners want to check you out?
My next event is in Kalispell, Montana on the 13th. Then I'll be in Missoula. And then I'm going to bike to every bookstore on the Kenai Peninsula in Alaska during the month.
That's, you know, classic book tour stuff. Yeah. Kalispell.
Do you know what? You've inspired me. Tomorrow I'm going to get the blue raspberry Slurpee.
Don't go too extreme. You got to ease yourself into it.
You're right.
Yeah.
I spent some time on the Kenai Peninsula randomly years ago. I did a sketch show about the history of Alaska, wrote and performed, toured all around that area. And it is wild. We did a show in a Russian Orthodox village. We had to take four-wheelers down into it. And they were like, we'd do some improv. And we're like, okay, give us a one-word suggestion to start. And they were like, tell us what it's like to live in New York. And we were like, okay. More than one word. And they were literally like, there's no tall grass. Where do the animals go to the bathroom? I was like, there's a lot of things to mention here. It was wild.
Well, so I feel like you'll appreciate one of my favorite statistics then, which is that if Manhattan had the same population density as Alaska, there would be three people in Manhattan.
Oh, I wish.
Dream. All the 7-Elevens would be free and clear.
7-Eleven is your life, dude. Indoor kitty in the comments.
Yep, there we go. Tessa, this book is absolutely fantastic. Congratulations on it. I'm glad it's in the rearview mirror, and I'm excited to read what's coming next from you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
All right, thanks for great coming on. Enjoy the rest of the lumber. All right, there we go. Tessa Hulls, once again, the book is called Feeding Ghosts. It's absolutely phenomenal. You really are not prepared when you're reading for what it is, but block out some time. Get the book, read it. It will floor you. It's great. True. And we are going to move on with our next section, which is my favorite section because you all make it up. It is your audience question.
Yeah.
And for audience questions, all you got to do is drop a question in the comments over on Facebook. YouTube, X/Twitter, or Twitch. Not on Instagram, though. I'll check in on it. We'll see if anybody's asking any questions over there. But as usual, CBC chef Brett Macris usually curates or creates a cocktail for us. This week he curated one. It is Martini Week. I did not make a martini, but I did make this drink that I've been making. It's rye, maraschino, and punta maize, and it's very good.
Wow, very nice. Did you get new glasses, Alex? Very cool.
I don't know. I think they were sent to me by some TV show, and I don't remember which one.
Nice. Are you drinking out of a candle?
It's a candle, yes. It's a
candle. Love it.
What are you drinking? Or
what am I drinking? A little bit of Miller Lite.
Excellent.
I'm upstate with my family. We came up here into the path of totality on Friday for the eclipse. So I've been here for many days consuming many different cocktails. So
excellent.
I have shifted to a lighter bev for the show.
Well, cool. Actually, before we get to the comments, this is a question that's been sitting here for several weeks, and I do apologize. It was sent to us on Twitter/X from Andrew Softly. Hi, CBC. Do you know of any comics set on a desert island? I'd love to read something with a Lostian setting.
Desert island. That's such a specific question.
The first thing that I thought of, and actually, let me look it up to make sure I'm not getting the comment wrong. Was Morning Glories by Nick Spencer and Joe Eisma. I mean, that was not on a desert island.
But very Lostian.
Yeah, but it very Lostian. Yeah, Nick Spencer had pitched it as Runaways meets Lost. So that's one. There was also, what was the James Tynan book where they were all in a school and it showed up in another dimension?
The Woods.
The Woods. There you go. So that's another great Lostian one. Again, not on a desert island or anything like that.
Yeah, it's funny to be like, the thing I love most about Lost is the island.
One I throw out, how about Avengers Arena by Dennis Hopeless? That's a bunch of teen Avengers related characters end up on an island that is run by Arcade. And it's a little more like Hunger Games Battle Royale, but it's great. So
That's a great call. I'm just capturing the Lostian vibe. I was gonna throw out Local Man. I mean, I just really love that book, but that has the constantly revealing another layer of like, oh wow, this seemingly normal place is actually a hotbed of deeper and twistier mysteries. If you like that sort of style of storytelling, peeling back the onion.
Well, thank you for the question. People can always hit us up on any social platform at any point. Happy to read them here on the show. We got a question here from Pete LePage. Says, is Justin in the army? What's the deal with his shirt? Is he on a set or something? And for anybody listening, you're wearing a regular blue shirt, I think.
Regular blue shirt. It does have sort of a little thing.
I see.
Where was I? At a thrift store in Detroit. And I really like it. But I am not in the army. I like Pete Sick, and he's like really contributing to the show in the comments. It's great.
Yeah. Pete, I love get some rest.
He liked when I turned the lights on. He's more of a directorial persona. It's fantastic.
It's good. It's good to get notes in the comments from Pete. I really appreciate it.
Congrats, Pete. You just got promoted to doing this every week.
Got a question here from Schreikler. Who are your favorite unicorns? I assume this is tying into the fact that today is National Unicorn Day, which we all know.
Wow. You know, it's crazy that you knew that and Schreikler also did.
Right. The reason I knew it is as part of my new job where I review junk food and whatever, I got invited by Haribo.
You mean or dream Haribo, job?
My dream job. Haribo? Is that how you pronounce it?
The I gummy believe it's Haribo. People.
Haribo. They, in New York for National Unicorn Day, they took out a 1,800 square foot apartment in Soho and made it into like this Instagram fever dream unicorn palace for the new unicorn gummies. And I got to visit this weekend with my family where I presented it to them as like, hey, do you guys want to go to a gummy unicorn apartment? They're like, what are you talking about? And I was like, legitimately, I don't know either, but let's go.
Dad, you say something like that every weekend. This one better be real. You want to go to an Oreo water slide? It's like, what are you even talking about?
But yeah, they had double up the whole apartment. They have like a life-size unicorn sculpture in there. They had a ball pit filled with hundreds of unicorn plushies. And they, it's probably gone by now, but they had a thing where like people could actually stay there for 2 nights, but it's only like 3 groups of 4 or something like that. So, oh, also to the Haribo thing, there's literally like packages of gummies and canisters of gummies always within arm's reach anywhere, including on your nightstands for when you're about to go to sleep and you pop a couple of gummies.
So what a nightmare.
It was great. It was a good time.
Great. So your favorite unicorn are the hundreds of candy ones you ate
that day? That I ate.
Great. I mean, shouts to Applejack and Pinkie Pie, I guess, if our name unicorns.
Here we go. This is from the Pay Me in Williams. I feel safe finally asking since Pete isn't here. Do you think Pete is a land in disguise? He seems to mention it every week.
Land.
Land.
I don't know what that means. Is that a typo?
Probably.
And if he were, I know he wouldn't be some sort of fuck island because he certainly hates that. But if Pete were a piece of land, I'm going to go with archipelago.
Hmm. Stanley wants to know, how are your experiences watching the eclipse?
He's a land shark, is they pay me in wines, is saying.
Okay.
If Pete's a shark, he's a street shark. No doubt about that.
100%. Or maybe a battle toad, one of the two. Yeah. Experiences watching the eclipse. I could go first because yours was probably cooler. So in New York here, we had a 90% eclipse. I walked into the park, hung out, had my eclipse glasses. My wife met me. We hung out for a bit, watched the eclipse happen. And it was very fun. Much more dramatic than I thought it would be. Like, it didn't get totally dark here, even with 10% of the sun. But it definitely, the light got weird. It got noticeably colder, which I was saying to you before we got on, that totally makes sense, but nothing I would have predicted. Just like that it legitimately was like, oh my God, it is cold out now because the sun is gone. And then when it hit its highest point, which was 3:25 p.m. here in New York, everybody in the park clapped. But it was it was very funny. And it was like a very like, woo, we did it. And then everybody sort of turned around and went home. So that was cute.
What about you? New York thing. Here is my experience. Can you see that?
That's my wife. Nice.
That's my wife demonstrating the eclipse with a plum, which I was like, wow, what a fun way to do it. No, I came up to the Path of Totality in upstate New York, like I said, and it was fantastic. We got to see, it got full dark. We saw the ring, the diamond ring when it first pops back around, you get to see that. It got super cold. As soon as it dipped, a bunch of mosquitoes like woke up and came out and started biting us weirdly.
Oh no.
Which I was like, cause they were like, oh, it's time for us. It's dusk.
Oh, it's time for us vampires to come out.
Yeah. We didn't have too many like animals freaking out, but a ton of people came up and joined us here. And it was just unsettling, strange as it's happening. We had some cloud cover, but then it faded right when we needed it to. And then the way that just the light changes and everything is there's no other experience like it. So it was very, very cool.
Yep. Pretty awesome. This is from Frederico Rosa. Are you guys going to do rewatch episodes on non-MCU Marvel movies before Deadpool? I would love to do that. I know Pete has been very reticent to revisit the X-Men movies. I rewatched them with my son recently because he's obsessed with X-Men. But I think that would be great. I'd like to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I think we should definitely have some nice build up to the Deadpool movie. We could also poke around with some of the rumored plot things as well and rewatch some of the movies that we believe they're going to reference in the movie itself.
Ooh,
I mean, watching the original Daredevil, that would be...
I've watched, of course, the seesaw scene and the Evan Efton scene nonstop for years, but not the rest of it. Pete LePage says, oh, I'm the only one who didn't like the X-Men movies. No, that's not true, but I, yeah. You know, some of us, Pete,
we're real fans.
Not to talk directly to you, just like to take a little side thing here. In your new position as director of Comic Book Club, you're going to have to remove yourself from your emotions a little bit and think what's best for, you know, the content that we're creating is the phrase that I like to use.
That's right.
And, you know, it's good to revisit some of those movies and talk about them.
He'll get on board. As a director, he's going to be much more reasonable to deal with. I know that. All directors are all super chill. No, no.
And I think that's it for your audience questions.
What?
I know. There's no more unless I missed one. There was one I missed, but I'm not going to read it out loud. Why don't we move on and talk about what is coming out this week that we're looking forward to? We got no trivia because Pete ain't here. Justin, what are you looking forward to?
A lot of great comics coming out, but the final issue of Dungeon, Scott Snyder's book, is coming out. Very excited for that. That book has been creepy and terrifying and strange. And to bring it to a close, I'm very curious how that's going to happen.
A lot of stuff I'm really looking forward to as well. Ultimate X-Men number 2 from Peach Boboko. That first issue was wild. Also, new issue of Beneath the Trees Where Nobody Sees from Patrick Horvath at IDW. Can't wait for that. But the big one I'm really intrigued by is Uncanny Valley, number 1 for Boob Studios by Tony Fleeks and Dave Wachter. This is about a world where cartoons and real people, though it's in a comic book, collide. Great team. Very excited to see what
the classic Roger Rabbit situation.
Yeah. And hopefully at some point somebody dances the Roger Rabbit, but I guess we'll see.
Yeah. That's your dream. Besides candy journalist.
Well, I made one of them. Let's see if I can make the second one happen. And folks, that is it for this week's show. A couple of people we want to thank. We want to thank Tessa Hulls for coming on. Don't forget to check out Feeding Ghosts in bookstores everywhere. Also, Alex Schumacher for The Effects of Pickled Herring. That is also in bookstores everywhere, so definitely check that out. Next week on the show, we're going to have two more great guests for you. Christoph Bogax is going to be here to talk about Under Kingdom. And also, David Popose is going to be back on the show to talk about the new Space Ghost that's coming out from Dynamite. I'm sure we'll sneak in some Punisher questions as well. We'll see what happens. A couple of other things to plug. Comic Book Club News, our daily news show. Check that out Monday through Friday. Marvel Vision, our Marvel podcast. We're talking to X-Men 97. Maybe soon, some of the other Marvel movies. We'll see if we can convince our director to allow us to do that. Podvincible, our Invincible podcast, just wrapped up season 2. Patreon.com/comicbookclub. Support this show and all the shows we do. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple, Android, Spotify, or the app of your choice. At Comic Book Live on Twitter/X. Comic Book Club Live on Instagram and TikTok. ComicBookClubLive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, good night.
Good night, folks.
Thanks, everybody. Have a great night.
Good night, folks. See you next time.